From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we learn about Ladarius Marshall, a local teenager imprisoned for murder and released 12 years later after a federal judge found police violated his constitutional rights. Then, contributor Kyle Cherik explains how the lack of federal and local leadership in restaurant operations has led to public distrust.
That a restaurant could operate with five going cases, and there's no mechanism to let the public know. It's only an anonymous tip by somebody who works there who doesn't want to go back for their own safety, and the restaurant is allowed to continue being open.
Plus, in this month's Milwaukee Music Roundup, we learn what some local musicians are creating during this pandemic.
People are taking the time to kind of just go above and beyond and not just put out a song, even though any new music at this point is welcome, but I love it when people throw us a curveball.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Ladarius Marshall was just 16 years old when he was accused of murder. Despite little evidence, Marshall was sentenced to 20 years in prison and 10 years of extended supervision. But after years of appeals, Marshall was set free when a federal court found the main piece of evidence, Marshall's alleged confession, was the result of police misconduct and a violation of his constitutional rights. Marshall had already been in prison for 12 years. Attorney Matthew Pinnix represented Ladarius Marshall in his most recent appeal, which ended with an order to vacate his conviction. He joins me by Zoom. Matthew Pinnix, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a bit about the initial case that landed Ladarius Marshall in jail.
Sure. About 12 years ago, there was a homicide in the city of Milwaukee. And what happened was the police didn't have any witnesses. They didn't know what was going on in the case. And they didn't know who might have done it until one day they picked up a guy named Michael Winston, who they were going to charge with other criminal acts. And Mr. Winston decided that he wanted to get some credit for information that he had. He wanted to maybe do himself a favor. So he told a very self-serving story in which he pointed the finger at Ladarius as being involved in the homicide. And it was from there that police began to suspect Ladarius's involvement and ultimately went and arrested him at the time. He was 16 years old when they arrested him.
What kind of evidence did they have besides the word of this other man?
They didn't really have any other evidence. In fact, as would later come out in the criminal case against Ladarius when he was at sentencing, the state's attorney told the judge the reason that they were giving Ladarius the deal that they were giving him is because there was really no other inculpatory evidence against him besides the statement that he had given to law enforcement.
Well, and that statement is really what is at the center of all of this. As you mentioned, he was only 16 years old at the time. He was still a kid. Are the police allowed to question children like that without a parent?
Yes, they are. And they do it. And they do it with some frequency.
So we have this kid who's in police custody. Tell us a bit about what happened next.
Well, they take him down to a building in downtown called the Police Administration Bureau, and they put Ladarius, then a 16-year-old kid, into a very small room that is pretty barren. It's got just a table and a chair and a place where you can actually handcuff people to the wall. A wooden door that has no window. And they leave him in that room for the course of, I think, somewhere around 16 hours, I believe, in total. And they interview him over that period of time for a total of 7.5 hours. So he's allowed out of the room occasionally, but not frequently. So he spends the better part of a day in that tiny little room with repeated interviews from law enforcement until finally they squeeze out of him a statement in which he admits his involvement in the crime. And then they let him go down to the juvenile facility in the southern part of Milwaukee.
Well, and something that hasn't been brought up yet, but is important to this story, Ladarius has some learning difficulties. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. At the time that the case was going on, his trial attorney got an expert to evaluate him and to give some information about his cognitive capabilities, and it was determined that, you know, he was cognitively delayed.
What kind of impact does that have in these kinds of situations where it's already pretty stressful and he's being asked about a crime that he perhaps wasn't involved in?
It obviously has an impact. There was testimony in this case that it would have been difficult for Ladarius to read or to understand certain information that was being conveyed to him. So, I mean, as you point out, obviously he's in a high-stress situation. He is being held in custody by himself with no access to friends or family. He repeatedly asked to contact his grandmother, who was a significant person to him, and the police repeatedly refused to do that or defrayed the request until telling him basically that he needed to tell the police what had really happened before he would be allowed to speak with any caregiver or person who would take care of him. So I'm sure in those circumstances, you know, a person who's not functioning at the level of a person of that age normally is really going to be impaired.
Yeah. So he was given a pretty hefty sentence. And of course, it went right into appeals. This case went through a lot of different layers. What did it take to get to the point we're at now?
Well, it took a long time and a lot of work. You know, Ladarius' original appeal was based around whether his statement should have been admissible at court. His original attorney had challenged the admissibility of that statement during the trial proceedings, arguing that the law enforcement officers had violated his rights. And that was denied in the Milwaukee County Trial Court, which led to Mr. Marshall's plea because, as I noted earlier, there was no other evidence against him, but it was pretty strong evidence. It would have been difficult to beat a trial. So he took a deal and he was sentenced to prison, and then he appealed that decision. That process, you know, the appellate process takes over a year. He went through the entirety of the Wisconsin court system. That was denied. And then he filed a petition in the federal court, asking the federal court to overturn what the state courts had decided, asking the federal court basically to say that his statement should not have been in evidence. And so that process takes itself a very long time. So it gets sort of hairy with procedural issues and things that are difficult to dive into, but I think it's extraordinarily relevant to this whole thing because it just explains how tilted the system is against criminal defendants and Mr. Marshall specifically. So Mr. Marshall, the whole time he's arguing his statement should never have come in. There was an audio recording of his statement that was made, and there was also a transcript, a written copy of the recording that had been prepared by his trial attorney back during the original state court proceedings. And when Judge Griesbach agreed that Mr. Marshall should have a lawyer, he also told the state of Wisconsin, the Attorney General's office, to provide the federal court with a copy of the audio recording and a copy of the transcript of the statement so that the federal court could review that and decide whether Mr. Marshall's rights had been violated. The state does that and gives the federal court on its order those two documents. And we get involved in the case and write a very lengthy brief explaining how the state court did not pay attention to things in the transcript, how its ruling was unreasonable because it didn't rightly reflect what was actually done during the statement, what police did or said to Ladarius, and how they pushed him, and how they refused to respect his invocation of his right to remain silent. And in response to the brief that we filed, the state of Wisconsin took the position that, sure, that's all well and fine, but you can't, federal court, listen to the audio recording or read the transcript, because those things were never introduced into evidence in the state court proceeding where the statement was tested. So that started an extraordinarily lengthy process where we, Mr. Marshall's lawyers, had to try to go back to state court and to get that evidence in so that the federal court could rely on it.
So it seems like there was just a lot of technicalities that they were kind of leaning on that didn't necessarily speak to whether or not the boy, now a man, was actually guilty, had actually committed this crime.
Well, that's spot on. I mean, it was all about technicalities. And I think that the state's attorney understood how difficult a case they had to prove that Ladarius' statement should have actually been entered into evidence. And so they were doing whatever they could to find some technicality whereby to keep Ladarius from succeeding. And they were really going to lean on this proposition that the federal court couldn't read the transcripts, I think, because if you read the transcripts, you can see that what the officers testified to at the hearing and what's in the transcripts are not identical. And the transcripts really show a constitutional violation.
So that's ultimately what the federal court found. This was a violation of Ladarius Marshall's constitutional rights.
Exactly. That's correct. You know, a person has the right during questioning by law enforcement to say to the police officers, look, I don't want to talk to you anymore. And at that point, if a person says that to police, I don't want to talk to you, I'm done talking here, the police are supposed to respect that. And they're supposed to stop asking questions. And Ladarius repeatedly told that to the police, and they failed to respect it. In fact, at one point in the interview, Ladarius sort of says, well, I'm done talking to you. And the police just sort of said, well, okay, well, we'll take a break. We'll be back in a minute, which is completely improper. They then let him sit in that room for a couple of hours and just stew. And he asks the officer outside the door to bring the detectives back so we can find out why he's been sitting in the room for 2 hours. And that's all he wants to know. All he wants to know is why he's been left in the room for 2 hours. And when the officers came back, they just started up again, questioning him and defraying his attempts, his continued attempts to refuse to talk to them. And it was just an egregious affront to his rights. I mean, he's a 16-year-old kid, you know. No one should have to endure what Mr. Marshall endured, and anyone's rights should be respected. But, you know, to me, it's just incredible that you have a kid, a child, as you noted earlier, who's there, and these are adult police officers whose authority they're just imposing upon him to get him to say what they want him to say.
What I found interesting about his release is it seems like, and I don't know how typical this is, but they released him. He didn't have supervision afterward. And while that's undoubtedly a success in some ways, there are also some troubling aspects of that. Can you dig into that a bit?
Sure. You know, he's been in prison for 12 years. He was 16 when he went in. So he's 28 years old now, and he's spent his entire life in prison. he missed the entirety of the Obama administration, and he's walking out into a pandemic, a global pandemic, as a man who hasn't had held down a job for 12 years, as a man who has no education to speak of, absent what he might have obtained in the institution. And he's expected now to just transition into society that's markedly different from the one that he walked out of. And the DOC, the state of Wisconsin, doesn't owe Mr. Marshall, according to them, anything, because he's not going to transition to supervision. He's not going to be under the purview of the Department of Corrections. He's not entitled to services that he would get if he was walking out as a person who's going on to supervision. There's not a halfway house for him. There's no career counseling. There's nothing, really. No support. He does have family in the community, and that's fantastic. But, I mean, just imagine if tomorrow, you know, you were taken to an entirely new place, and you were sort of told, okay, good luck out here. And you had been given, you know, nothing, to no money, no resources, no guaranteed place to live. I mean, that's what happened, and that's, to me, another frustrating aspect of this case, that really all is the result of a continued attempt by governmental officials to keep Mr. Marshall in custody for as long as possible.
So what is next for Ladarius?
Well, he presently is out of custody, and I am certainly hopeful that Mr. Marshall will have a very productive and fruitful life from here on out and can put all this behind him. My understanding is that Mr. Marshall is going to look into whether he can get compensation for the violation of his rights. And if he can, I say more power to him, and I'm hopeful that he's successful, because he deserves it.
Well, Matthew Pinnix, thank you so much for joining us here on Link Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Attorney Matthew Pinnix represented Ladarius Marshall in his most recent appeal, which ended with an order to vacate his conviction. We'll take a short break now, then contributor Kyle Cherik joins us to talk about the lack of leadership in the hospitality industry. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Restaurants have been given the go-ahead from the city of Milwaukee to open dine-in services and operate with safety and capacity limits. But many restaurants are still struggling. Some have decided to close temporarily if any coronavirus cases are reported among staff or customers. But there aren't actually strict protocols to follow. As restaurants adapt new best operation practices largely on their own, culinary historian and contributor Kyle Cherik says this is causing a significant drop in public trust. Cherik joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to discuss how this diminishing trust and a lack of leadership could ultimately leave restaurants behind.
I mean, it's such an interesting time in American hospitality history, and I would requote what Andrew Zimmern said, that others have said in so many ways, but he put it so poignantly, we're facing an extinction event. And I expect by this fall and winter, we will see drop-offs of restaurants closing that will never reopen. And a good deal of that is because of the lack of leadership and the lack of support from the federal level all the way down to municipalities. And then people's distrust, just regular old patrons, distrust of knowing whether it's safe to go and support the restaurant that they've always abided by, loved, celebrated birthdays, grabbed a quick bite, and everywhere in between. In this process, as we live forward with the true reality, right? This isn't the V recession. This isn't the bounce back. This isn't everything is going to be great by fall and kids go back to school and it's going to be all the same.
Restaurants in itself are kind of representations of their neighborhoods, of their municipalities. So with that lack of trust, do you think more shared and transparent standards, either from the city of Milwaukee or other places of authority of health departments, could help make a more transparent? Because really, right now, it is up to individual restaurants. Do I stay open? Do I close? We've seen some voluntarily close after learning of either a worker or a customer coming in having COVID. They are voluntarily closing for a couple of weeks, getting tested. They don't have to do these things per se, but they're holding themselves accountable. So how do you think that restaurants can go beyond individual choices of transparency and reestablish trust in the public? Because we have to decide our daily activities. Do we go out? Do we not?
Right, right. Well, there, I mean, you hit it on the head. There is literally no leadership from the federal level on down. At the federal level, we have press conferences from the party in power that are changing the direction of what is best and safest on a daily basis and contradicting themselves. The experts in the room, the scientists, and this is a scientific, you know, experience that we're going through. This is not a political experience, are not having their say or their platform. And so, you know, I mean, there was a survey in 2017 that I found where a really good, you know, a good sampling of Americans were surveyed, and their trust in the two major institutions that should be weighing in daily and regularly through the federal level, the FDA and the CDC, the trust by Americans in 2017 of these federal institutions, in which there's a lot of distrust from Americans across other federal institutions, the trust was somewhere between, it sort of depended on different circumstances, but between 95 and 100%. That trust is vastly eroded, and that comes from the federal level. From the federal level, then it shifts down to the states, and the folks in power have said, we're going to leave it to the states. The states are very good at very many things, but they're not good at rallying scientific, you know, perspectives on their own. I mean, we are supposed to be the United States of America. And when we have a global pandemic that affects a nation, we should have a national standard and a national approach. So you have governors and their legislatures and advisors left to their own wherewithals relative to, well, that's the mess that we saw in New York, but we're not going to have it in our state or XYZ. From that state level, you know, it transfers down to cities and municipalities. And I think really all of it can be encapsulated in the incredibly shallow and disappointing quote by Mayor Barrett on June 4th when they announced that restaurants could open up on June 5th at 2 p.m. with 25% capacity. He said, and I quote, we're counting on business owners to make smart decisions. That's the most nebulous and undirective statement you could possibly make in the middle of a pandemic where you're talking about an industry, hospitality, where the very nature of it is close interactions between peoples for a quotidian experience, which is three square meals a day. So I had thought, and this is purely my opinion, but I had thought the previous commissioner of health, Bevan Beyer, was perhaps the worst one we had when it came to our lead crisis. It turns out that, there's a new low, I would say, in the directives that were given to restaurants and hospitality. So the mayor announced municipally that they could reopen on June 5th at 2 p.m. with no directives in place, no standards, no specificities, no anything regarding health. And there was a huge, huge, huge revolution from restaurants in the city. You can look it up on the Milwaukee Record, where a lot of the I think it's June 5th that all the postings came in, where a lot of the restaurants weighed in after the Record reached out to them. And they basically said, hell no, we're prioritizing the safety of our patrons more than we're prioritizing your mandate, which is just one of those like, get back to business, everybody, which speaks beautifully to the hospitality industry and what's really in people's hearts, but so underscores the endemic problem from the federal level to the state level to the municipal level that we have, and really the folks that will end up holding the bag, or rather with empty hands, will be this nation's hospitality industry because of the lack of leadership and perspectives and paradigms on how we safely re-engage with customers that come in to be fed.
This is an industry that also relies heavily on planning. You can't open a restaurant within a day. Once you close it, you can't snap your fingers and reopen. There's menus to plan, there's food supply, there's deliveries, and all these things are just compoundedly more complicated right now. So do you think that having more input and standards from the city or wherever restaurants are residing is necessary? Because I imagine people who own restaurants have enough to worry about when it comes to planning a menu and reducing capacity and operations. How can we expect them to become CDC experts or guideline experts and do their own research to pick and choose what is best for them?
Right. Well, to your point, it's an absurd thing to ask them to do. And there's a couple of outcomes that you can have. So to their credit, or rather doing their jobs, the Commissioner of Health and the Health Department has put out a form for restaurateurs, and it's very accessible on their website, and a checklist and so forth and some communication. I think it's kind of a C-plus type form, but at least there's something now. One of the largest restaurant groups in our city, in a conversation that I had a week and a half ago, when they looked at reopening, basically said, we laid off 98% of our staff, which numbers in the many, 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 many hundreds. So we're down to core people. We have the capital, and I'm basically turning them into a research group to pull in all of the data and all of the methods that are being used in Europe, across the United States, from the CDC, from the FDA, when that's relevant, and so forth, to put together our own manual on how to open up. And then they plan to open up their succession of restaurants week after week after week after week and learn real time. Now, that's a fantastic way to deal with this if you have one, a pretty large volume and a number of restaurants. But that's also, that's a Disney level way of handling things. If you're a restaurateur with one restaurant or something like that, to your point, you can't just flip the switch. It's not like making dinner at home. So that's where I think a lot of the ire from the hospitality community came from, when the city said, oh, tomorrow at 2:00, you can open up. Because these people are also professionals, should be respected. And restaurants, when run well, are some of the cleanest places on the planet, at least in America. So you're starting with a template where folks are already incredibly conscious of sanitation, but to your point, now have to take it to a different level. And then we've got the trust issue from the public. Well, back to the mayor's words, we're counting on business owners to make a smart decision. So you have the owner of Kilties, which has been in the news on JS Online, that they had that custard stand out in the Lake Country. 5 confirmed coronavirus cases in employees there. The employee that called the paper and is choosing not to go back to work spoke anonymously because of their fear of retribution. But there's no mechanism within anything from the federal level to the local level that if there are confirmed cases that the restaurant has to let the public know, identify these people, send them home for their 14-day quarantine with some modicum of pay through the federal experience or the state experience or something like that. Provide free testing. I mean, there's nothing there. Basically, folks were going to Kilties as customers, feeling safe, getting what they were getting, their custard, their burgers, or that sort of thing, enjoying the experience. It's one of our favorites every summer, and being exposed to 5 people who had the coronavirus. And it was only when an employee essentially spoke anonymously. I mean, this is crazy. This is like, the insanity just blows my mind that a restaurant could operate with 5 going cases, and there's no mechanism to let the public know. It's only an anonymous tip by somebody who works there who doesn't want to go back for their own safety. And the restaurant is allowed to continue being open. Now, I'm not trying to focus solely on Kilties or make an example, but we're seeing this across the whole southeastern Wisconsin hospitality world. And then there's other restaurants where they have one case, they realize it, and they shut the whole thing down for 14 days. Highly responsible, great, but what does that do to their business in the short term? However, for me, it does inspire trust that this is, a responsible community partner. And after those 14 days are open, it's probably much safer to go and get carry out from them.
You mentioned a lot of this is exposing just the lack of accountability on many fronts. And different restaurants are deciding what to do based on those individual people running the places. But in the grand scheme of things, on, quote, the other side of this, however long it lasts, The landscape of neighborhoods might be changed due to what restaurants are open or closed.
Profoundly. I mean, they're the wildflowers that when you pull back from space, you see the whole, you know, half of Australia is yellow or something like that, those great pictures. But, you know, it's just one little tiny flower. But then seen from above, it's such a fantastic patchwork quilt, really. And restaurants are specific to place. They create neighborhoods. They create communities. They create locations. They create cities. That's what they've always, always, always been. And the history of restaurants is about placemaking. And I would say everywhere from, you know, the corner pizza place all the way through the roadside place. If you're driving from here to San Jose, there's a different tone, tenor, and style of every roadside place that you stop that informs where you're at in the country. With those disappearing, and they will, many of them will, one, because of the confidence of consumers going out, and two, because they're not this monolith of an industry. They're not the auto industry, the healthcare industry, the agricultural industry. They have some trade organizations for sure, and the American Restaurant Association has done a really great job of lobbying Congress for more funding with some superstar chefs, Tom Coliglio and others, coming out saying this money is really vital. And the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, I think, has done a good job with their part. And then other groups like the MRIC are coming together. But really, it's specific to the neighborhood and the location, and the leadership isn't there. And as these places fade back and we lose them, we lose some of the spirit of our places. I mean, if you go through, and I won't take the time here, but every major city in America, there's a food or two or three foods that are identified with that. Those foods, every single time, come from what was originally a neighborhood place, and they've grown to become part of our identity. What's happening now is a really profound soul death in American food, and I hate to think about what's on the other side, but the tragedy for me is that a lot of this doesn't have to happen. If we had more leadership, if we had more specificity, if we had more trust from the public to then come to restaurants and more protocols, these really unsexy words that are so crucial and meaningful now, if we had more of that, and I'm loath to place blame in places, but in this case, I really feel I'm comfortable doing it. I don't think we'd need to lose as many of these great restaurants as we will be losing.
Well, certainly something that we'll keep tabs on, that is ever changing, and unfortunately, sometimes for the worse.
Yeah, well, someday, our conversations will get back to, you know, tomatoes coming in season and great barbecue and Christmas stories and all the things that really fill in the gaps in our life that make it so wonderful to live.
Definitely. Well, Kyle, thanks so much.
Thanks, Audrey, and stay safe.
Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik is a culinary historian and essayist. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can explore his past segments at WUWM.com. After a short break, we'll have the latest Milwaukee Music Roundup with Milwaukee Records, Matt Wild. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Although most live shows have been put on hold by the pandemic, Milwaukee bands are continuing to release new songs, and Matt Wild has listened to most of them. Wild is one of the co-founders of Milwaukee Record, which describes itself as an online source for music, culture, and gentle sarcasm. Among the many cultural things Milwaukee Record keeps track of is a nearly exhaustive list of new music from local musicians. Wild is the curator of that list, and he joins me every month to share with us a sample of what he's been listening to for our Milwaukee Music Roundup. Matt Wild, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me back. Glad to be here.
So despite the pandemic, despite closing and then reopening and then kind of closing again, we are still getting a pretty steady stream of music from Milwaukee musicians.
The music has not stopped. It will not stop. It will never stop. Maybe thankfully, the novelty of writing songs specifically about the pandemic seems to have cooled down a little bit. But people are still very, very busy here in Milwaukee, all the Milwaukee musicians, putting out a ton of great music. As always, hard to keep up with all this new stuff that's coming out, but I try my best.
Well, and you do a pretty good job. This is actually a very interesting collection of songs, very different genres. So we start off with actually a friend of Lake Effects, Be Free.
Be Free, yes, the incomparable Be Free, always a very, very busy, very, very prolific Milwaukee musician, a very, very talented singer-songwriter. She's also is the correct word a flautist for someone who plays the flute? Am I correct?
I believe so, flautist.
Sounds about right to me. So she plays the flute. She's a great flute player, let's just say that. And she's put out a ton of music in the past few years, and pre-pandemic certainly, very, very busy, very visible, playing out a lot of shows and things like that. And this song that we're going to be listening to here in a bit is notable for a few things. It is a collaboration. It is a duet with someone. His name is Quentin Farr, and he's not just, he's the keyboardist and frontman for a group called For the Culture. And perhaps more importantly for our purposes here, he is the husband of Be Free. They are husband and wife.
I was about to say.
What's interesting about this is that this song, the song that we're going to be listening to is called Say It. And it is, in fact, their first official duet release together, which is something I didn't know. For some reason, I had thought that they had collaborated a lot together in the past, but apparently this is the first time they've really gotten together and made a song. And it's not just a song. It is, in fact, a celebration. They put it together to commemorate their four-year wedding anniversary, which I think is just so heartbreakingly sweet. I'm a sucker for that. I'm a sucker for any kind of artists who are partners who get together and do a song or an album or anything like that together. It just, it melts my heart. I'm just such a sucker for that sort of thing. So it's great to hear Be Free and Quentin Farr collaborating here on this great track. It's called Say It. It's a lovely song. It's got some very serious tropical summer vibes, a terrific song. And if you listen all the way through, Quentin Farr pops up near the end of the track, and he's rocking a talk box, one of those things where you just talk into the thing, and it sounds like, you know, I don't know, that Peter Frampton album or whatever. I love the talk box. I'm also a sucker for the talk box, so I'm just a sucker for the whole thing. This is Be Free and Quentin Farr with Say It.
That was Say It by Be Free and Quentin Farr. So coming up onto the next song, we're taking a big left turn in genre.
We are, and this is a really interesting project. I hesitate to call it a band because it's not a band. It's a kind of a solo project. It's a new project called The Beat Index. Now, The Beat Index is kind of a solo slash pandemic era project of another very prolific and very, very talented Milwaukee musician. His name is Harrison Colby. And folks who follow Milwaukee music will know Harrison from a lot of terrific groups in town, most notably the Delphines some years ago, and then the Delphines kind of changed into this incredible band called No-No, and Harrison was one of the co-front musicians for that group. And No-No has since broken up, and so Harrison, he's been busy with a lot of other things, but this is his latest project. It's called The Beat Index. And he's putting out, I think it's out now already, he's put out a album, it's called Juvenilia. And it's a collection of songs. It's kind of a loose, I guess you would call it a concept album. I'll just read directly from Harrison here. He says, The Beat Index is a sort of tongue-in-cheek compilation series. It's an opportunity to examine different artistic constructs and experiment with them through music, video, and design. Volume 1, Juvenilia, focuses on nostalgic filters and their impact on modern media, using the sonic and visual nostalgia in a modern application, like retro Instagram filters and vintage treatments in music. So each song on this album is a little bit different. The one we're going to be listening to is called Record Collection. And if you listen to this song and think to yourself, gee, that sounds an awful lot like The Strokes, that's kind of by design. It's kind of, I wouldn't call it a parody necessarily, but it is definitely written in the vein of kind of a garage band like The Strokes. And the song itself, like I said, is called Record Collection, and it's a pretty funny, pretty brutal takedown, kind of poking fun at the kind of person, 99% of the time that person is a man, who kind of defines himself by the music that they listen to and the kind of vinyl records that they own and like, kind of, you know, it builds their whole identity out of, you know, what they listen to and what kind of awesome records they have. And this song kind of name checks all these kind of almost very obvious cool records that you would, that a person like this would own, you know, bands like Talking Heads and Television and all this sort of thing. But it remains, I think, a really funny song and a really catchy song. So I think he does a terrific job. It's The Beat Index with Record Collection.
I like listening to vinyl because it sounds better. Vinyl kind of has a warmer...
Listening to Record Collection by The Beat Index. Coming up for the next song, this was a really interesting kind of feel. I'm not that familiar with Abbie Jean, although I hear her name all of the time. She's a big artist here. But the song that we're about to hear feels very vintage, almost like a surf rock.
You are absolutely correct. And in fact, it is a cover song of a very, very old song from the 60s. It was released in 1967. The name of the song, I should say, is called Stop and Listen. And it is a cover of a song from a Milwaukee group, in fact, called The Shag, who released a couple records back in the 60s. This was released on Capitol Records, in fact, in 1967. And it's one of those songs that, you're absolutely right, it's got this surf, early garage vibe to it. And it's one of those songs that I know and I always forget is from a Milwaukee group, but it is in fact from the Shag. I think there were about 9,000 bands back in the 60s and 70s that had the name Shag or the Shags or some variation of the Shags, but this was the Milwaukee, the Shag. And Abbie Jean, as you said, is a very big name here in Milwaukee. And pre-pandemic, you know, of course, that's tossed a monkey wrench in everyone's plans, but she was kind of, I think, in the midst of kind of really working on some making some big moves, I think. She released a really terrific record early last year called Music Box Dancer. And she's been spending a lot of time in New York and L.A., kind of making these kind of big career moves, kind of quietly behind the scenes. And like I said, the pandemic has kind of put everything on pause. But look for her in hopefully the near future, making some big moves. And in the meantime, she's put together this cover of this classic Milwaukee Garage song called Stop and Listen. And I think she does a terrific job of making it her own and staying faithful to the original recording. So yeah, it's terrific. It's a melding of two great Milwaukee artists. So it's Abbie Jean with Stop and Listen.
Listen, performed by Abbie Jean. So the final selection that we'll be looking at, similar to Stop and Listen, has a very vintage feel, but a very different type of vintage.
That's right. We are talking Mega Man vintage here. We're talking about some video game music, some early video game music, like Nintendo era video game music. The story behind this is very, very interesting. There is a Milwaukee group called Space Raft, and they put out a terrific album this year called Positively Space Raft. And we may have talked about them on the show before. It's a terrific album, and the lead singer and kind of front man of the band, his name is Jordan Davis. At some point, he decided, even though he had no experience doing this, he decided he wanted to translate his band's music into 8-bit Nintendo-era video game music, you know, real bleepy and bloopy, what they call chiptune music. So he kind of just threw himself into this project of translating his band's new record, Positively Space Raft, and change it into video game music, 8-bit video game music. And he's done just that. He has the entire album available. It used to be called Positively Space Raft. This is Approximately Space Raft. It's the 8-bit Nintendo version of his band's record. Now, not only that, but he took it about 8,000 steps farther, and he created an entire video game around his band Space Raft.
We're actually going to hear all about this. I just interviewed Jordan about creating the video game, so our listeners will get to hear how that whole process went down. It is fascinating.
It is fascinating, yeah. It's terrific. It's a big project that he took on. I should say, even though I did not ask him to do this, but he kind of surprised me, I actually appear in this video game. Milwaukee Record appears in the video game as two little characters, myself and my partner Tyler Moss. So thank you, Jordan, even though you didn't have to do that. And I love this video game, even if I wasn't in it.
All right, so here is the song, the approximate song, Please Be Kind by Space Raft.
Thank you.
Please Be Kind by Spaceraft. So, of course, you know, we're still not having a lot of shows in the area. While some things have opened up a bit, we're seeing things shut down once again as COVID numbers continue to rise. What are you looking forward to in Milwaukee music? Because despite not having shows, there's still a lot that's happening.
I guess I'm looking forward to these kind of surprise, kind of left field releases, kind of like what we talked about with Abby Jean and certainly what we're talking about with Spaceraft. I really like when people are taking the time to kind of just go above and beyond and not just put out a song, even though any new music at this point is welcome, but I love it when people throw us a curveball and really like, hey, I'm going to, you know, make some 8-bit Nintendo music or do this random cover of this random old 60 song. I love that. And there are other artists doing that sort of thing as well in town. Groups Luxie, she's another one who puts out tons of electronic music and occasionally will create an entire video game for her music. She's just one of those super prolific artists. So I absolutely love that. And like I said, if there are any other couples out there in Milwaukee music, please make some adorable duets together. I love that. I'm such a softie for that sort of thing. So please continue doing that.
All right, a call out to all those couples with instruments.
Couple skate, yeah.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thanks for having me.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month he publishes his Milwaukee Music Roundup and joins us to talk about a few of those songs. You can find our previous conversations with Wild at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Audrey Nowakowski, Becca Schimmel, and Angelina Mosher Salazar join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Jack Urbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayan Silver from the WUWM News team this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can join us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.